Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm George Chen, and this is SupDoc, where we discuss documentaries with our guests, comedians, writers, musicians, personalities, if I may say so. This episode, I spoke with the musician and writer Eric Stoyer about one of his favorite documentaries, Exit Through the Gift Shop. The only film attributed to Banksy, 2010's Exit Through the Gift Shop tells the story of Thierry Guetta, a self-taught street artist and filmmaker who becomes the subject of his own street art documentary. It's a funhouse mirror of the art world and a prank that folds in on itself like an Ouroboros, and the viewer rapidly descends into a vortex of what-the-fuck moments. Definitely watch this film so you won't get spoiled by our conversation here. Eric Stoyer works with artists, media companies, technology developers, and cultural institutions on the use of Creative Commons licenses and Creative Commons licensed content. Before joining Creative Commons, Eric was an editor for Wired Magazine, where he is currently a correspondent, covering the intersection of technology and popular culture. As a musician, he's released a bunch of recordings and remixes, the latest of which is Dos Filas' EP, Most Realist, available on Plug Research Records. And now here's me talking to Eric Stoyer. And we are here with Eric Stoyer.
How's it going?
Very good. I feel like we've never actually had a conversation in real life.
I was thinking about that the way over. Like back when I first got to the Bay Area, I remember hearing your name all the time. And my friend, you know Frankie Kohler? You know
Toured with the first tour that either of us ever went on was a tour. It was Jimmy Oshie Pileup, my band Box Lightner.
Right.
Which maybe you know Ian Connolly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And Ian Connolly was in Box Lightner. Uh-huh. And Cassie Tone for The Painfully Alone. So it was like the first time any of us went on tour. And I think after that was when Sequoia was like, I never want to do this again. And the very famous Jimmy Oshie Pileup, for a small cluster of Oakland people, the slowcore heroes of Oakland.
That's right. So I remember hearing your name a ton right when I first moved up, which would have been like 1999.
And, from LA? Is that where
I moved from Santa Barbara. I went to college there. And and just over the years, I mean, I've definitely like been familiar with a lot of your projects, and I've always felt like we were kindred spirits in a way because we were both just involved in a lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. And
you were like the rap guy, and yeah, I was like the noise rock guy.
What a thing to be known for. I remember actually one of the first jobs that I had in San Francisco, there was a woman that I worked with, Sonia Jawinski, and we had a record out, and she's like, why is George Chen's picture on your record? And I was like, it's a photo of me. And so it confirmed my idea that we were kindred spirits.
You look Asian in your photos.
I was wearing glasses.
That's very weird. Yeah. I remember that. That's funny. That's the late 90s scene of San Francisco, because I know you also worked for Wired for a long time.
Yep.
And you may not remember this. When you guys moved buildings one year, I knew Chris Becker.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had no job at the time. I was like between jobs. I was like just like floating around doing the weirdest jobs. And Chris is like, you want to help me move a building?
I'm
like,
of course.
Yeah. And then it just was clearly like I was not cut out for physical labor. It was just basically me hanging out by the reception desk, and Chris is like, hey, check out this room full of old computers. I gotta move all these old computers.
Did you at least get anything cool out of that deal?
Well, weirdly enough, we found a box of like Anna Marie Cox's old stuff from like years before when it was CNET in that building. And it was like her diploma and like of like zines and stuff. I'm like, you might want to give her diploma. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if she ever, and now she's a big deal.
Yeah, she
was
is.
Like in Downsizing.
Right.
If you saw that.
Right.
It's like very strange. It was weird that like early kind of like you could be like an early internet celebrity in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Didn't take much.
It didn't take much. No. I got written up in some like SF magazine or something for having the most Friendster friends that you could
have. Man, that is the most dubious distinction.
Very dubious distinction. And I'm like, am I proud of that? I'm just bringing it up. It's just like letting you know how low the bar was in San Francisco at the time.
Chris is still at Wired. I think he's the longest running employee of all time.
He must be.
Anywhere.
And he's a hoarder. He is, if you're listening, this guy is the biggest hoarder. But he has the weirdest stuff. He has probably an old Commodore 64 or something sitting around.
That's kind of stuff he has. He has a lot of records too, and he's got good taste in records.
So many records. I was like, I'm glad I never got asked to help him move, because that, oh my God. So just to round, that was a little catch up / first time caller. You're also like a Patreon supporter of our show.
Yeah, I think it's a great show. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that you're the first time I've booked someone who's a Patreon supporter to be a guest on the show.
So folks, if you want to get booked, you know how to do it.
Exactly. It could just cost you $1 a month to do. And now you're just telling me that you work at Creative Commons now.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you can, that's something you can talk about?
Is absolutely. Yeah. Creative Commons has been something I've been involved with off and on for a long time, but I work there full time now. I do a combination of sort of creative direction and projects with artists out in the world who are interested in using what we call an open approach to distributing and sharing their work. So what Creative Commons is basically like, you know, there's this thing called the public domain, which is creativity that is fallen out of copyright. And so it's available to anyone in the world to use for any purpose. But then like everything else is typically locked up under much more restrictive copyright. And so there's this middle ground that Creative Commons has been trying to carve out for the last several years that gives creators easy ways to say to the public, like, my work is available to you to use or to share or to build on top of under certain rights.
Yeah, I know Free Music Archive, WFMU, is one of the main things. Like, I've got some music up on there, too.
Yeah, they're a great partner. They're super awesome.
Yeah, like, and something falls into public domain, what, like, maybe 70 years or something?
Yeah,
like
I mean,
that.
It's it depends on what era it was created in, but actually it's usually 70 years after the creator's death. So it's a really long time. And, you know, that's why that when people think of the public domain, they think of it as really dusty old stuff. It's because it is. Actually, in 2019, in January, will be the first time that a bunch of new stuff falls into the public domain.
So is a happy birthday song in public domain yet?
Yeah, that is sort of its own story. It was, you know, because there's obviously a lot of financial upside to owning and asserting the copyright around that song. So for years, a company that owned it, I think it was Time Warner, actually, they said, no, it's not in the public domain. But then in the last couple of years, a judge actually said, this is in the public domain. So now you can, you know, when you go to Chevy's or to Denny's and it's your birthday. First of all, I'm sorry if you're at Denny's on your birthday, but if you are and they come and sing to you their own birthday song, that's why they never had just happy birthday, the regular old version. They always had their own signature version of it because they would have to have paid a giant company the right to sing it. And so now you can actually hear the real version. What an exciting thing.
That actually means like all those alternate happy birthday songs are now like rare B-sides.
That's
Like now there's going to be a market like who owns those? Like that's I guess Denny's owns like their weird birthday songs.
You were thinking of a new music project that you could compile recordings of all
all the new birthday versions. Yeah. So we wanted to talk about you just brought up that you wanted to do Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Yeah, we talked about a couple ideas and that was the one that you thought resonated the most. And I'm really big fan of documentaries. That one I think was the most like fun of the ones that I pitched to you. There were a few that were maybe
there's
a little
some
more
that are
grim.
Like, I think you said like, let's do 13th. I'm like, we could.
Not a lot of,
it should be done at some point. I mean, we just did Central Park 5, which was pretty heavy.
Right.
But we found some like stuff to play with in there. But this is all just very low stakes, except for I think at some point I felt a little bad for Terry Guetta, Mr. Brainwash, when he's like, I had to refinance my house to do this. I'm like, oh, anyone would tell you that is a terrible idea to do.
A lot of bad ideas, but he actually seemed to make it work, didn't he?
He does. And I was thinking about like a couple things when I hadn't watched this in a while. I watched it last night and it is plays like a great comedy because of I think in the beginning, a lot of people thought it was a put on kind of back then. But then I also thought of this, like here's a guy who like since like the 80s has just been filming everything around him. And in like the years came out like 2009, 2010, He was like, what a weirdo. And now it's like, that is standard. That is the standard thing.
I was totally going to bring that up. It is. I remember totally feeling like this guy has, you know, something wrong. And they make reference several times to him having some sort of
ADD.
You know, yeah. Like, well, they, you know, like there's, they kind of jokingly refer to him as someone who has mental problems, with that being a big piece of it, is that he's like sort of this character, but he's also, I think, maligned a bit for his, you know, filming of everything. And it is absolutely not a strange thing to imagine. I mean, I'm walking just here from about two blocks where I got dropped off. You saw, you know, four or five people literally doing just that, like filming their entire lives. It is certainly not a unique or novel thing to be doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the fact that he had like a Tupperware bins filled with, I guess, Hi-8 tapes that went back God knows how long, and like he wouldn't label them or anything. And the way he made his film was just randomly picking tapes out and being like, whatever. I actually watched on the DVD extras, there is a 14-minute cut of Terry's movie,
Life Remote Control.
Life Remote Control. And it said, like, we had a lawyer look through all of this, and this is like the most we could cut it down to. This is like the lawyer edit. It's 14 minutes. He's like, there's 70 more minutes of this stuff. There's just like interviews with people in downtown LA. There's like, he I think he runs into Gondry. He follows around a couple other random people, Almodovar, and he's just like,
oh, I saw
night
it, yeah.
Visioning, like just like shoving a camera in their face. And Almodovar plays along with it pretty well. But yeah, I guess in like the late 90s, that would have been pretty unfamiliar kind of territory for people. Yeah.
Yeah. I watched, I mean, it may have even been a shorter version of it that's on YouTube. I mean, or I just stopped watching it because it is literally an intolerable movie, but the, I think, Dov Charney, or at least there are many people that look like him, the LA dudes from 2008 or whatever that it looked like that. But yeah, like that whole scene. But that movie is rough. It's rough to watch. It's also rough to imagine an adult cutting that together and thinking that it was like saying something, because it is like the equivalent of when you first encounter anything that enables you to edit stuff.
And yeah,
like,
oh, iMovie for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just the like a rapid fire series of, like, it's like, apparently MTV had expressed interest in actually airing it at one point. I was reading about it, which I mean, it seems too ridiculous and scattershot even for the, you know, the most like sort of parody version of MTV at that era. But apparently they were interested.
It actually, I thought of one other thing that this reminded me of as I was watching it. I didn't think of initially is, have you ever seen Nathan Barley?
No.
So it's like a British, I guess, sitcom, kind of single camera shot on film. A comedy that is basically, the premise is, it's like a guy in London who works at a magazine that's kind of like Vice. And then there's like a guy who's just basically like the proto Vice guy, and that's Nathan Barley. He's just like, he's like a vlogger, he's a columnist, and he's just sort of like everything that is hateful about those things. Mm-hmm. And then there's a guy who also works for the magazine who views himself as like the authentic person.
Ah, yes.
And so it becomes this tension of like, I'm pure, this guy's an idiot. And he's like, but you work for the same magazine. And right. That's kind of like, when I think of like what the dynamic is set up in this film, it's like Banksy as like the genius. And then Mr. Brainwash is kind of like the kid brother, like the tag along.
Terry's cousin was Space Invader, a major player in an explosive new movement that would become known as street art. This hybrid form of graffiti was driven by a new generation using stickers, stencils, posters, and sculptures to make their mark by any means necessary. With the arrival of the internet, these once temporary works could be shared by an audience of millions. Street art was poised to become the biggest countercultural movement since punk. And Terry had landed right in the middle of it.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So I went down a little Wikipedia hole about Mr. Brainwash Terry Guetta yesterday and found out that someone that I'm friends with on Facebook had like thrown paint at an exhibit of his in London. So I wrote him last night. I'm like, hey, do you want to say anything about this on the podcast? So I just asked if he had a beef with him or what was going on. And this is Raymond Salvatore Harmon. He's a painter, music producer. And I just was like, what was the story here? And he wrote back to me. He said, I took out the front of the shop with a couple of gallons of paint, mostly the sidewalk. Mr. Brainwash was born out of a thing happening here in London that Banksy capitalized on. I had a relationship with Banksy, having pranked him over a fake Tom York video I made. The Mr. Brainwash show I attacked was his first in London, so I figured he needed a proper street welcome. So I think there's a lot of questions about like who owns or defines street art. I think that also is something that could be explored in a real documentary, which I guess like Beautiful Losers kind of gets into this stuff too. Right. But in this, it's just more like, hey, it's personalities. You want personalities? We're giving you personalities. It's almost like Banksy's like, I'm actually not that interesting of a person outside of my work. And here's a really bizarre dude. And the fact that it's basically like a film that was unwatchable gets turned into another film. And now it's like produced by Banksy. And he's kind of just like, yeah, this is, I guess there's a lesson here. I don't know.
Right, right. Yeah, that even that interaction that your friend had, it's like, you know, I think initially, like you were indicating at the beginning, you and me for sure, when I first went in to see the movie back in 2010, and when you would read about it, the New York Times wrote a thing asking whether this was all a hoax or a prank, and then there would be people who would write these essays about why for sure this whole film is a Banksy prank, et cetera. But there aren't people actually who have interacted directly with Mr. Brainwash who say that he's not real or that this isn't an accurate representation of who he was. In fact, I was talking to a friend who moved to LA maybe 7 years ago from Ohio, and he was an artist, and he answered a ad on Craigslist, and it was very vague and anonymous, you know, as to who he was going to be talking to. And he went in and he ended up interviewing with Mr. Brainwash to be one of these people essentially that's working
the
as
graphic
his student.
Designers.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And he's like, no, dude, it's real. And then there's actually, I don't know if you have show notes that you publish with the episodes, there's an AMA on Reddit, which is with a guy who had known Terry Guetta for years, had been working with him when he was just a photographer, even before he'd met these guys. Uh-huh. And he swears to God that this is like a real guy. Nothing about it is a put on, that there's maybe aspects of his trajectory that were sort of guided with the, you know, the idea of turning this into a narrative that it ended up becoming. But even says, and I think this is something that makes a lot of sense, is that in order for it to have been executed to make the point that it so flawlessly ends up making, they would have had to have done so much, and it would have been an improbable result that they could have gotten to trying to engineer this. They couldn't have reverse engineered it and made this happen as perfectly as they did. And that is sort of his contention, is that I know this guy, he's a real guy. And the way that this all ended up, it just was too perfect for it to have been all planned because of, you know, the messiness of who people are, et cetera.
Yeah. Like the fact that there was so much that was left hanging to hang of the art show, like an hour before opening.
Right.
And he's just like randomly running through there. And he has like, I believe he broke his foot and he was on the real thing, because why would you add that complication? Like, that doesn't necessarily, I guess it makes him maybe a little bit more sympathetic. The things that make him sympathetic are he is a family guy. He does seem to be like putting a lot of financial risk into like these types of huge shows. And also, like, he's, you know, he hurts himself. So, mm-hmm. like, there's these moments of, like, when he's, like, marking all the posters by just, like, being in a wheelbarrow, spraying them around. It's just, like, the hubris and like the kind of lack of self-awareness makes him like the perfect, like the best kind of documentaries about like a weirdo personalities. Like American Movie is a very good analogy to this film. Just like someone who's like got the hubris, but then like somehow they pull it off. And like it's sort of like you want to root for them, but you also want to slap them in the face so many times.
Yeah, and that scene is the best. I mean, he's like he's dripping paint onto these prints to give them their own individual stamp as if he's fucking Jackson Pollock. But he's like doing nothing with technique. It's just literally like shitting on these paintings and then turning or these prints and pretending that what he's done is great art. I mean, the other thing that makes him sympathetic to a degree is that they make, you know, I think he has a fair you could say pretty fairly that he does his own work to make himself look like a bit of a buffoon, but they also treat him like a cartoon character. I mean, every single scene that he's on, there is traditional romantic accordion French music playing in the background as if he's Pepe Le Pew. It is just silly.
That's true. Yeah, like all the music scoring, which also saw that Jeff Barrow did a lot of the score and like Roni Size did stuff for, which I guess they're all like Bristol dudes. I didn't realize how much stuff was coming out of Bristol, like all the stuff like Massive Attack, Banksy, all the Porter's Head people, all that stuff.
I think Tricky and Goldie.
Yeah. So, and Bristol is like sort of has this like rep for that stuff now. I found him, to be a complete kind of cartoonish character. Actually, it was reminding me, I think one of the first, before I ever saw this, I think I heard Paul F. Tompkins on a Comedy Bang Bang or Comedy Death Ray back in the day. He was doing Mr. Brainwash as a character.
Really?
Yeah, he would just do like, I'm Mr. Brainwash. And just like a guy who just was like a total oaf. But like he just extrapolated just from the little details you could get from this movie. And like, yeah, this is like a human cartoon character. This is insane.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. And it made me actually think that how hollow all this work was. I'm like, is Banksy even that good? That's what made me think at the end of this. I'm like, clearly like Banksy sees this as like a shadow version of himself, right? Or like kind of like if it was only just the hype, what would it be? And the content has been completely, you know, had all relevance taken out of it. And then it's like, is Banksy actually any good? Is another question at the end of this.
I think that's a question that Banksy is asking, actually, because, I mean, he sort of seems aggravated by the fact that, I mean, the film is obviously, is an obvious point, but it's about the sort of triumph of marketing over content. And then when Banksy has his big LA show and he walks away with having, you know, sold it out in 2 seconds and Brangelina are there and he's made, you know.
Jude Law. Jude Law is at Banksy's show, right?
Right. At Mr. Brainwash.
We're talking about Banksy's show, right?
The Banksy
now.
Show, yeah. Right. So the
with the elephant, which is like a huge,
barely legal, right? The one that was in Skid Row, mm-hmm. And so you know, he sort of seems aggravated himself about his own show, referring back to it as having been this thing. I mean, it's the same art that he had been doing, but that he had all these celebrities and all their people and their handlers basically saying this is the hot shit to go to. So it's a different version of saying like, you know, is the stuff that I'm making. Is it good or is it just hype
spectacle
that brings these people out to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for the work?
Yeah. And like it's interesting being around, like I guess the closest thing I've seen to this, and it's not someone I know personally, but I remember seeing all the Barry McGee stuff around the Mission in like the 90s. Like I would go to like this punk space like Epicenter and there was a huge Barry McGee Buddha in the back of the wall, and then there used to be one in front of luggage store. I just noticed that's gone. I don't know if someone just ripped that whole storefront metal thing down, probably so they could own a Barry McGee. That also happened to my friend's place out in Oakland. Like they had a Barry McGee out front of their place and someone just came and took it
like on a wall
off the wall. It might have been on like a boarded up window, and they just unscrewed the boards and took the boards. So like that sort of hyper I don't know if you'd call it a graduation into fine art. I was also at the show that was like a big Barry McGee show at Deitch Project in New York in like 2000, and like I just went with my friend because she was really into all this street art stuff. I'm like, I kind of remember this guy from San Francisco, and he'd taken over a whole building and there was like vans and stuff, and that was kind of the peak of like San Francisco people really blowing up. It was like him and Chris Johansson and a lot of people that are mentioned in like Beautiful Losers and stuff. So I kind of had seen that happen, where with Banksy it's like become, I think the timing of Banksy, they kind of address this in there. It's like also the rise of like, you know, web video, like just being able to circulate on the web In a way that you weren't able to before that.
Yeah, I think that it's sort of a predecessor to what ended up becoming called memes, which are these symbols that repeat. I mean, Shepard Fairey is really big on that. It's like a lot of the Obey stuff. I mean, way back in the day, you know, remember
the sticker
seeing
era,
the sticker?
Yeah.
I mean, just those Andre the Giant sticker. I mean, what does that actually mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's just the idea that it repeats and that you see it everywhere ends up sort of becoming the context for it and the meaning.
Right.
It reminds me when I was watching and I was thinking of in the book White Noise by Don DeLillo, there's the thing called the most photographed barn in the world or whatever it's in America, I think. And it's only meaning is that it is photographed more than any other barn. And it's exactly sort of the same point that's being played out with a lot of the street art. It's completely, it's temporary and it has like, 1 second to say something. And so it's like this flash, an image, and it will go away. And the idea is to sort of just recontextualize and repeat it as many places as possible. Elevating that above the idea of spending, years crafting like a single masterwork. It's really like this collective body of work that just is ends up being everywhere.
That's interesting. Now I'm thinking about like how where you work now, or like this idea of like sampling, which is a lot of like, I think conceptually like graffiti and sampling, you sort of could fall in the same category. Mm-hmm. It's like reuse, right? Mm-hmm. And then reused in terms of like memes, right? Like, I think about it like as an analogous thing. It also just seems very 90s. All this stuff seems very like obviously Shepard Fairey like was birthed out of an 80s 90s kind of aesthetic, but like even like when I think about like Don DeLillo, right, like or White Noise, it's like these sort of like discussions about like postmodernism and stuff that are like very like seem very of an era, and like they need to kind of be updated, because it seems like even what's happened with Banksy is it's kind of outstripped his ability to like control the narrative at all.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that ties those two things together that you were talking about, and also kind of places them temporally, graffiti sampling, there's two things. I mean, one is that they're both sort of meta art, so they're like they're taking something and part of the expression of it is actually like having context for what it was, you know, like it's with sampling. And then if you're taking images, especially in the case of stencil art that people are familiar with, but then you're putting a new kind of sheen over it and just saying something new by actually executing it. That's a lot of the meaning is just in the execution of the fact that it exists. The other thing is that they're both sort of, they're subversive in the sense that neither one of them asks for permission, especially like old school sampling. I mean, now there's like deals that are, negotiated around every sample that is used in something that you would actually end up hearing somewhere. But I mean, back then, I mean, the entire basis of hip hop was about taking stuff completely without permission and make something new out of it. And, graffiti is certainly, the sort of display of art in public places is done without permission and done like in many cases sort of at the risk of being busted.
Oh yeah, that the Disneyland story is great in here, which is also like, I'm surprised that they had that footage, because it sounded like he deleted some of the footage, or he had to like take the tape that he had taken and hide it in his sock, and that's how he was able to like not turn over the footage with Banksy's face
right
to the Disneyland people. And I've also heard other stories about people getting arrested at Disneyland. Apparently, it's like a super fascistic place. And they're like, the fact, like, when the roller coaster goes by once, and there's basically like an inflatable doll of like a Guantanamo prisoner, and then just all of a sudden the roller coaster slows, it's like, folks, we gotta slow down here. It's like, oh fuck, because they think it could be a bomb or something.
Right. I mean, and imagine nowadays how quickly they would.
And that was after 9/11 too.
It was, right? But I mean, it's not. I imagine the security at Disneyland has not gotten more lax. Like, wow, that scene is incredible. That's right by Thunder Mountain, and they just straight up shut it down.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever get into? I guess you do graphic design, or do you?
Do graphic design. I've never done a graffiti guy.
I had this moment when I was like, I don't know, I'm 30 maybe, or I'm just like, I'm just going to go stencil in Oakland. I don't know what I just like had this idea that I was going to do it. And then I just kind of gave up. I gave up pretty quickly, but I was kind of inspired by the Shepard Fairey stuff. Also, did you see Shepard Fairey's documentary, Obey Giant? Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen that.
That's on Hulu. It's pretty good. I mean, it kind of breaks down his story. It's very like a hagiography of him. You know,
it's pretty earnest, right?
Yeah. And he is very open about like Andre means nothing. But then what seems to have happened later for him is especially with the Obama thing, is like he does want to like basically create positive propaganda. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be like what initially was just like, it's funny, I work at a skate company. People just think this is just a goof and I'm making a shit ton of money from it. And then now he got to the point where he's like, I got enough money, I got to like try to like make things better. So he's done all these like pro-immigrant posters and things like that. Obviously the Obama thing was a huge thing. Also a lot of it, of that doc, hinges on that issue of like who owns that image. It's like a photographer from the Associated Press. They end up kind of settling something out with each other. But it does seem like he just kind of like wasn't on top. He's been like violating rules the whole time. The whole point of his thing is to violate the rules.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same with Banksy, right? That's the same thing.
Yeah. I think maybe he wasn't prepared for the reality of doing something when it passed into the, you know, the mainstream like that. I mean, you ended up taking this, or creating this art that really passed into the more legitimate, or at least the more, not legitimate, the more mainstream consciousness and
condoned.
Yes, exactly. And it had, I think a legitimate effect on the, you know, sort of political, discourse and people's awareness of this idea of hope at the time. So it was I think a very different type of project for him, and maybe he wasn't ready for it. And one thing I want to say about him, about Shepherd Fairey, is that, you know, the Exit Through the Gift Shop is always described as the Banksy documentary, and it is that. But I mean, Shepherd Fairey is just as much a character and much of a, he's even maybe more so a catalyst for Mr. Brainwash to really exist, you know. And I'd forgotten that. I mean, when I saw it, I remember thinking, oh, that's the Banksy documentary. And when I would refer back to it over the years, I'd always think of it that way. But watching it again now to talk about it here, I was reminded, wow, this is really just as much about Shepherd Fairey.
Well, it seems like he taught him how everything worked. And then like the first piece that Terry puts up of himself, the kind of stencil image of himself with the camera, that's all, he's going to the same spots that Shepherd used to hit too, it seems like.
I read actually that he had the photo, but then he basically had someone from Shepherd Fairey's studio create that illustration. So even that original piece of propaganda that Mr. Brainwash was putting up, he didn't create that himself.
How meta is that? Like, it's his propaganda for himself as a documentarian, as a quote unquote filmmaker, which he doesn't know how to do. I was going to say the film that he makes, it just seems like the quality, right, of like someone who's just learning iMovie and threw something on YouTube. But again, it's kind of like the fact that he was filming everything. If he would be just like Facebook Living everything now, or Snap or Instagram storying everything now. But like, yeah, what he made, if he had just thrown it on YouTube, it would have gotten a few views. It would have got a few, like, okay, it's something someone made. I mean, it seems like a teenager made it.
Yeah.
He does seem like he is always like a perpetual teenager also. In this way, I've known some adult perpetual teenagers, but in this way, it's like, I can't believe he's anyone's dad.
Yes.
Like he's like a dad of like three kids.
An adult man. It is hard to take that. I mean, you mentioned earlier that it reminded you of someone's kid brother, and that is absolutely how he comes off and what he reminds me of too. I mean, I was thinking back to being in high school and, you know, there'd be kind of hangers on, sometimes younger, but sometimes not even younger, just kind of people that you could tell were a little bit posers, like in the punk scene or whatever. And it's like, they, you know, you can glean enough from kind of looking around to know what are the right hairstyles and the t-shirts and shows to show up to and stuff like that. But there's just like something else about the people that are actually doing it and creating the new stuff that is just different. And so he really reminded me of that. And it also, I mean, like, it's like not out of the realm of possibility. I was thinking about like imagining some punk band back in the day touring with some shitty fake punk band to make a point. And it kind of reminded me of that. Like, I didn't know there's an actual example of that, but I was thinking like, wow, if like
new wave bands, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe like they brought, you know, brought like a mall punk band or something, you know, they just brought them around to make the point that like this is different, but also not as something you were talking about earlier, is one actually better than the other, or is it all just sort of something that is subjective and up to like, you know, whether people are going to make snobbish judgments about what's good and what's bad?
Well, I guess this is a podcast, so what we do is make snobbish judgments about good and bad.
Opinions are
all
good
the time. Yeah, with Banksy particularly, I guess I would say I'm a fan in general, but not to the point where I would like go out of my way to go see anything, or, you know, I didn't see this film until it was on DVD or whatever. So I think of him as being like almost like from that school of like Crass Records, but then minus like actual rhetoric, or like it's sort of like it's all it's a, it just seems like it is like all meta stuff about. And it seems like him and Shepard Fairey are kind of cut of a similar cloth. But Shepard Fairey seems so American in that he's just like, yeah, I sold a bunch of sweatshirts. And then Banksy's like, well, what does it mean really?
Right.
Or like, am I any good? And right. Like, or is anything any good?
Yes. He has a real existential quality about him that I don't sense in Shepard Fairey as much. He's also much more of a smart ass, I think. Mm-hmm. Like him, Shepard Fairey seems like. Especially maybe when you see a film of him in, you know, in the more recent times, that he is like just much more of an earnest guy. And I use that word not as a negative at all. It's like he just doesn't seem like, you know, that everything that he does is like a middle finger out to the world.
Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten about that whole Paris Hilton CD thing.
That's what I was going to bring up. So yeah. That's the kind of stuff that I would say. Like, you couldn't go see that in a gallery. And just basically for anyone listening, like Banksy and Danger Mouse, there was a Paris Hilton album that came out, and they basically smuggled in remixed copies of it that had altered artwork, like with her little chihuahua or whatever is juxtaposed with her face, her actual head on. And then there's all these sort of like existential, like...
Or just kind of like, like piss tape. Yeah. I guess it's very British, like piss take culture thing.
And then Danger Mouse like took all the songs and turned them into something else. And I mean, the best part about it is not creating that. You know, you could create that and like sell it as a remix, and it's kind of funny. But they actually like stole all of the actual Paris Hilton CDs from Virgin megastores around England and replaced them with these. They scanned the barcode.
So that's why I was wondering how the shop dropping was working. Because I could see just making a bunch of CDRs and then just dropping them in the shop, but you couldn't sell them if they didn't have the barcode. So, okay. So they actually kept the top spine and they just reused a jewel case.
Yeah.
And so they did that for 500 copies only around England. And then I just looked it up. They're going for like they've gone for like $3,000.
Right.
There's people trying to sell that disc on Discogs for $600.
That's amazing.
At the low end. And then also there was a second edition of it too. So it's like the anything tied to these guys has now become way more valuable than a fucking Paris Hilton CD all. And like they've actually like surpassed her fame in a certain way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, on that, I mean, you were saying that you weren't sure that you would go see a Banksy show, for instance, and I actually probably would. I consider myself a fan, and I think he's really funny, but stuff like that, like, you couldn't go see that in a gallery. Like, that's the kind of project that's, like, a fun, interesting thing to think about, and, like, what does it mean, like, the Paris Hilton project, but you wouldn't necessarily display that. And so there's this, you know, Banksy show that his former gallerist is putting on in Toronto right now, and it's kind of getting not great reviews, right. And Banksy has nothing to do with it. Like, he's not involved with the... curation of it or anything like that.
The name of this guy, and he's featured prominently in the documentary.
Steve Lazaridis,
yeah. And he, who again, is like, I guess you could say like a Malcolm McLaren figure, right? A guy who's like, I had the business savvy and I knew how to market this stuff. So
yeah, he was involved in street art and sort of, you know, bringing that to the more mainstream and legitimate, you know, fine art world even before he met Banksy, as far as I understand it. So he does play a big role in the, you know, the marketing of that culture. And what, you know, what's interesting about that show is that looking at the pieces of them that are being displayed, it's all stuff that you're pretty familiar with. Like it's, you know, the guns and the gas masks and the, you know, flowers and the grenades and those kinds of things. And yeah, in and of themselves, it's like, would you go see that? And is it interesting to see those things that you've seen a billion times, not only like pictures of that one piece online, but actually that piece itself replicated. So like, it's not just like there's this one original. It's literally like a stencil that's being, and so, yeah, like it is interesting that what's I think so compelling about him as an artist is not that you could collect all of his past work and display it in a way where it would have the same impact as some other kinds of artists might, that actually it's sort of the ongoing nature of the projects that he engages in. I mean, going to the West Bank and doing something there in and of itself is an incredible feat and a really interesting idea, like that, to make that action art is different than just creating the piece and saying this is about the West Bank.
He's also seems to be doing more sculpture installation-y things around this time too, and also like there was some stuff on the DVD extras. I think this maybe is back in 2010 or 11, like some weird sculptures that were like, it's like a pet store and some weird, like a hot dog that's animatronic.
Oh, right.
Or like all these kind of other like weird ideas that are like, I mean, I guess it's what makes it pop art is that it isn't a conversation and it's sort of like more like a conversation starter in a certain way than it is like an aesthetic object into itself.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And whereas I think he even sees, it's funny because it seems like he's just like, I wanted to take all the tapes from Terry and make my own thing. And he sort of told him to go work on his own art, which he took as like the big brother being like, start your own band. And then he does the most, I guess it's unpredictable because I've seen this before and I kind of still am taken aback at like the radical turn he takes when Terry starts to go full Mr. Brainwash.
Right.
When he creates this other persona. I'm like, oh yeah, up until this point, it is still kind of like, there's this weird guy who just follows, he's like a hero worship guy. He clearly, they kind of allude to like him having some psychological damage from his mom dying where he's like, I need to document everything so I don't, you know, any moment could be the last, to then like, he's like, oh, I kind of know how this works now, to the point where he's like, well, you know, Damien Hirst has assistants. Right. He's like not even doing the bare basics of like coming up with doing anything by hand. Like to the point where like on the DVD extras, it's like someone bringing him a stencil of like one of the spray cans. And then he's using a real spray can to simulate this paint that's coming out of the paint of the two dimensional spray can. And then he's just like, I messed up. Forget it.
So bad.
It's just so, the meta layers that are just like, so just like when I kind of had this point where I didn't grow up. Like, I mean, I knew about art, but I didn't like, I was just talking about this. I didn't like know about like art school as a culture or like that phenomenon really. And then I kind of discovering it later, I've been like, oh, I could have done this. or just, you know, I mean, not to belittle people that went through that system, because I know there's like, everything has its ups and downs and foibles. But just like art has always seemed like, especially in the era that we're talking about, like late 2000s, kind of rose with like the stock market, kind of rose with speculation. And so it became like a speculative medium in itself. It's like, just like, I'm getting this because I think it's going to be a good investment down the line. I don't even have to like it. I can just stow it away. And like, that's what all these street artists started becoming part of, where they're not getting a cut anymore. Like Sotheby's or whatever is getting all the profit from that situation. But it does seem like a gameable system. And almost like this documentary just shows how gameable it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, get some press quotes, get an LA Weekly write-up, which in this day and age is not going to do much for you. An LA Weekly cover story is not going to do as much as it did back then.
Right.
But it's still just like about the marketing. Like we said, like, yeah, this is more about the marketing and the triumph of the commercialism.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's one thing I was thinking about with the sort of way that the timing around that is portrayed in the movie, and it relates to the LA Weekly article too, because it sort of makes it seem like, within a few weeks, you know, Banksy has said, oh, you should go, you know, leave me alone so I can deal with this footage and you should go have an art career. And that like 2 weeks later, he's rented the former CBS lot and his turn. But there's actually about 2 years in between there, because I remember living in LA that time and I remember just seeing these shitty pieces everywhere. And they were Mr. Brainwash throw ups or like, you know, the stuff that they show him putting up over in some cases, the Shepherd Fairey stuff, which is hilarious because he knows where all the best spots are. So he goes back to them and we'd paste his own posters over these ones that he was a part of having documented previously. Because there was, so it wasn't like it went from 0 to 60 that quickly. Like he had actually spent all, you know, a couple of years going back to all these spots that he had known about because he was there with these guys and was doing tons and tons of work to throw stuff up. So by the time that LA Weekly article came out, it wasn't like someone had just dropped a press release to the LA Weekly and said like, this is the big shit. Like there was precedent that existed for someone to be like, oh, okay, like this is that guy we keep seeing all his like ridiculous stuff. I think also at that point, like it was unclear whether that art, because it was so derivative and so basic, that someone who was
basic is the perfect adjective.
Like if an editor or a writer at the LA Weekly, like if they were wondering like, you know, is the basicness of it sort of a joke? Like, is it, I don't, you know, because if you go back, you the LA Weekly article that is referred to is online, and it's a pretty short little piece, and it's not like fawning over what a genius it is. It's sort of just
it's
about
a cover
like,
story. Yeah, which it's a cover story. Like, yeah. In 2008, a cover story in Alt Weekly means something different than it does now.
Yeah.
It's like basically Huffington Post front page. Or
right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And an interesting thing in that piece too, is they actually talk about him having recently broken his foot. So there's like some documentation of the fact that that's a legitimate thing that happened and was not staged or, you know. Yeah.
I didn't think that was, I think the first time I saw it, it just like, that is a turning point in the film where it's like, becomes even more through the looking glass than you would think. So it's just like, kind of all bets off in a way, but it's been 10 years now. And I think it's been established in every other footage of this guy. He's like, yeah, I have like some kind of ADD.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's closer to a character like the American Movie guy.
Yeah.
Mark Bort. I think that's more what it is than a prank that Banksy put someone up to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you still, when people talk about it, you'll hear them essentially, you know, opine that this is all sort of a construction, which I think, you know.
Well, the film is constructed, like you're saying, like that kind of like time jump. It's not like immediately he came back. And
yeah,
like,
the narrative is tweaked a little bit.
I made 2,000 paintings and screen prints.
Right. But he is a man. I mean, these things actually existed. This is a real, it's a real things that happened, and it's a real person. He's not playing a role. It's not like Mr. Brainwash is not, as some people maybe 10 years ago literally thought, like, is that actually Banksy? Like, is he wearing like a Frenchman's, you know,
you can
like
tell their
costume.
Body types are different.
Yeah.
Which also reminds me, I saw something a while ago, and I think maybe it was a DVD extra on something else, but Banksy's coming for dinner. And if you heard about this, I guess there was like this regular TV show where they would just have different celebrities come to someone's house in some English countryside. And so I watched this one with like Banksy. So he's not wearing a hoodie. He's wearing like a button up shirt. His face is pixelated, but I'm like, he could be Jason Statham. He could be Clive Owen. He could be any
some
random
kind of
ass white
hair.
Guy. I think he has a wedding ring in this film. So
we know that much about him.
Yeah. And then there's this theory that was circulating maybe a year or two ago. I don't know if you saw this, that he was actually in Massive Attack. That was one, someone put it together, like when the pieces would go up, and tied him in with Massive Attack tour dates. And like, they're obviously homies from Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
So it's plausible. And it seems like one of the guys in Massive Attack was also in the graffiti scene. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a graffiti artist. There's also been people that have made cases for why it's Jamie Hewitt, the Tank Girl creator who's in the Gorillaz.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, the last Blur album is the cover a Banksy piece. And sort of that was on the upswing before people knew as much who Banksy was and before he was so intensely focused on the anonymity piece. And
well,
so
I know the Tank Girl's artwork and Jamie Hewitt's artwork and stuff, and I feel like it doesn't look the same.
It doesn't look exactly the same.
Line is different.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it interesting to know who Banksy is? Because it's almost like now we know who Jandek is. And like, it's kind of like not quite as like fun.
Yeah.
Like Jandek's doing interviews, you know?
Right, right.
It's not quite the same thing.
And it's actually like likely that like if you know, the Banksy is not some other celebrity. I mean, it's like, you know, like that's the thing. It's like, yeah, it would be really interesting if, yeah, it turned out that Banksy was, you know, Donald Trump Jr. That'd be pretty interesting. But if it's just some other guy, yeah, like who's like a name that no one knows, like it's not interesting.
It's a Bristol bloke, or
right?
Whatever,
it's a dude whose last name is probably Banks. Like that's probably what it is. It's like, you know, he had a nickname at one point, and it just like turned into this thing. And yeah, I mean, who cares?
Yeah, I don't think like he's like, it's one of the last mysteries we have, though, I guess, as a public mystery, and I think that's why people are kind of still interested in it. And I feel like, yeah, the moment that he lets it be known who he is, it's not gonna really be that exciting for people to a degree.
Yeah.
I mean, I think then because everything about it that you would attribute to, like, when we look at art in a way where we kind of psychoanalyze artists, which we do a lot. I mean, I went to like this Cindy Sherman show, and it seems like, okay, everything is sort of about this sort of like persona and this like whatever her perception about like gender and stuff, but then you don't have that person to focus on with street art sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do. There's a cult of personality around this guy. We don't know who he is, but it's like, it's not, there's not like, the analysis, the reading is of the, It's like the reading is of the text and not the artist in a way, but then the text is also so referential to other things. I do think like one thing about Banksy versus Mr. Brainwash, one thing we can pick at is like Mr. Brainwash kind of is like takes a lot of cues from Warhol and just like reuse of celebrity images. And I think with a lot of the Banksy, it doesn't tend to like focus on celebrity as much as it does like, I think children are like a big theme. Mm-hmm. There's animals and children mm-hmm. in a lot of Banksy's work. And whereas like, I feel like Mr. Brainwash is sort of like at this developmental stage where everything's still like a human. Mm-hmm. Like he hasn't like moved beyond like, oh, it's a Leonard, it's Mr. Spock with, or just the fact that he's like trying to Warhol.
Yeah.
Like that is like,
I mean,
absurd.
Down to literally taking the same images. It's not like he's just inspired by the same process or doing these sort of like
he doesn't
tight
care about process.
Portraits.
I think that's why everyone's mad at him in the scene is like he has no actual process.
Yeah.
And it no is respect like I hired graphic designers to do everything and just think like, oh, but you're not a conceptual artist either. Like you can get away with that if you're a conceptual artist, but then, But then it's funny because it's like people like Banksy being like, he didn't follow the rules, but I guess there's no rules.
Yeah.
And like being like, oh, like that kind of frustration. I think if anyone's been in a creative thing and you see someone doing something similar to you and like, look, there's other podcasts about documentaries. We see that happens. And it's like, there's maybe a degree that is like professional jealousy or just like, you look at something like, okay, here's like my favorite murder. How did they, that's great that is huge. How did they come upon that? And is it pure chance or is it a combination of things? Or like, what is it that like catapults something into like this upper level? And
yeah,
to the point
where
like no one, like people still are probably happy they spent $20,000 on those Mr. Brainwash posters, even though I don't think it's like he's clearly just like pulling numbers out of his ass. I mean, like, do they enjoy it less after they see this is the question. Like, is this kind of like a prank on all the people who bought into it? And it reminds me in a way of the JT Leroy stuff. If you remember,
right.
If you saw those documentaries.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I guess it's a lot there. Yeah,
yeah, there is. But I think that I imagine that people who paid money for that seeing this or learning more about him, I think that they were there for something else. They were there because it is an item that they liked being a part of, the sort of like celebratory piece of acquiring it and being a part of something fun and big, and it seems like it's, I don't know. I mean, like you're talking about the process and the sort of lack of process and lack of respect. I mean, the thing is like just purely on the aesthetic level, that stuff looks no different than something you could get literally on any boardwalk in a city that has a beach. Like it is, you can get a Miles Davis print with, like the Photoshop that looks, in three different colors and the cover of Kind of Blue. I mean, the sort of memification of the Bob Marley front on shot. I mean, like, just like, it is really no different than that. It just has this other guy's signature on it. And I guess that is what people are paying for.
Yeah.
And that is ultimately also the question that Banksy's asking about his own stuff. Is it like, is it that did these people come to my big show? Do people continue to have interest in what I'm doing in this whole scene because it has been marketed into this thing that's been deemed cool or important? Or is it because they actually like the content?
Barely Legal marked the point at which street art was forced into the spotlight, attracting sudden interest from the art establishment. In the months that followed, prices for work by leading street artists rocketed, with collectors rushing to get in on this exciting new market.
Lot number 33A, the Banksy, the vandalized phone box. And I'll start here at $100,000, $110,000, $120,000, $130,000, $140,000.
Street art had become a white hot commodity. Now, no serious contemporary art collection would be complete without a Banksy.
Did you, were you a fan of some of the other people that were featured in like the very first like 4 or 5 minutes of the thing? Like, I didn't know anything about Space Invader before this. This might be the most I've seen about Space Invader. But yeah, like I said, like there was a little bit of Barry McGee kind of in the distance, a little bit of Neck Face, and I think Kaz is maybe the only other person I recognize. There's a lot of names I did not know because I'm not like really schooled in this scene very well.
Yeah, I mean, that whole scene is documented in some of the shows that traveled around in that era. I mean, like you talked about Beautiful Losers, there was a, you know, an exhibit that traveled. A lot of those people had work in there. And I mean, yeah, there was sort of, you know, a roundup of the names, the best names in that scene at the time.
And also like skateboarding seemed to overlap with graffiti, at least in like the practice of those people. It's a very masculine, like.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Very kind of a skater bro.
Oh yeah,
aspect of that scene.
Yeah, I think there was only one woman artist that was shown.
Swoon, yeah, I think, was shown. Right. And I guess like if you were to talk about just mission people, I guess Margaret Kilgallen probably would have been mentioned, even though I don't think it's the same kind of like we're gonna like, you know, it's more like mural, probably condoned murals versus like, you know.
Yeah, stuff you can do out in the daytime. Yeah, when people are watching and taking photos of you doing
it. Yeah, that is interesting too. It is like this whole thing is very like little brothers, big brothers kind of vibe to it. I think it might be, I hope it's different now. I don't really know what it's like now. I mean, I think graffiti, people will get stabbed over that shit, you know? So it is like a dangerous thing to be involved in. And even like the fact that Banksy was doing stencils was frowned upon.
Right.
There's a lot of people that are just like, that shit ain't legit to do stencils.
Right.
So yeah, it's a whole other aspect of that. But Neckface is someone I actually liked. I liked his work. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know if he's still around. I was asking someone about this the other day.
Yeah, there was like a huge rush of attention around his work for a while. And then
he's really young.
Yeah. He's a kid.
And it was kind of like very like metal stoner kind of graphics, which was of that moment.
Yeah, it looked kind of naive in a good way, like something that a kid would write on their notebook.
He did some crazy show here. We went to, I think in maybe like 2009 or 10, it was like a haunted house thing. It was like a Halloween show in LA. I don't remember what neighborhood it was in, but like there was like big installations in the middle of it in addition to his other stuff. But I think there's like this, like the speculation aspect of all this stuff too. I think it does have to do with the economy and like the fact that I've always, the street art is supposed to be democratic, supposed to be of the people. And, you know, these guys all kind of have a skateboard punk rock reference or background. I mean, I guess for the English people, it's maybe more like the KLF or like, you know, like that's a huge, like that prank aspect of it. I think the KLF is probably more of an influence on Banksy than Crass is.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah. I had not made
burning a million dollars, burning a million pounds.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you were talking about the relationship between the art, the street art market, the market around that, and sort of just the economy generally. And I think, there's like this impulse that people have to own a piece of it instead of just to appreciate it or talk about it or see it or know about it, that you have to like acquire it and have it in your home. And, you know, there was, I know after Katrina that Banksy went to New Orleans and painted some political art on some of the houses that had been ruined and abandoned. And then there was this whole other group of people that went there and fucking cut the shit out of the side of these houses and took it and then would sell it. And it had, you know, created this market around this stuff that was not really intended for that purpose, for sure.
But then there's also a question of like, what was his intention on like tagging all these like houses in New Orleans.
I think to draw attention. I mean, like, just, people were paying attention, but, like, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's like an artist could create a piece around Katrina, or you could actually go to Katrina and paint that piece on a house that's like in a total utter state of devastation. And, you know, that I don't know that it imbues the actual, like, the piece as an aesthetic expression with more meaning, but the act of doing it has, like, a lot of meaning to it.
Well, on the other end of that, I would be, I don't want to neglect an amazing fact that Mr. Brainwash was brought in to do a mural at Ground Zero. And people were just like, really? It's obnoxious. It's just like,
I
New York
did
is
not
beautiful.
Know that. Wow.
Yeah, it's like, New York is beautiful. It's like the most vacuous, like, bumper sticker thing
Holy
to say.
Shit.
And, like, people are just like, how did this happen? Like, why did they let this guy do this? If anyone's, like... I'm like, it's a questionable already. I'm thinking, I don't know how I'd feel if, like, Banksy showed up in Ferguson, for example, right? Like, if he actually was, like, just doing, like, stuff that had a little bit more specificity about, like, you know, like, murder of unarmed black kids.
Right.
Versus, like, kind of general, like, I mean, not to take away from what he did in Israel and in with the wall. I mean, like, that's pretty amazing of itself, and like that is like, I don't know, I guess it's still vaguely, it's still kind of vague, the message is still vague in a certain way, even though the act is obviously super political that he did that. But like, I'd feel like it's almost like slow your roll if someone shows up trying to do something in an active scene that they're not like really fully aware of all the context of, maybe historically, versus like, you know, then the guy who knows nothing or has no deeper, there's nothing to the signifiers when it comes to Mr. Brainwash.
Yeah.
And then you put him at the most potentially significant place you could put that.
Right.
Is that Ground Zero?
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, actually, because I mean, I think, like, you know, I know I personally give Banksy what I would say is a pass on those actions, because like, I feel like I trust his sensibility. But like, yeah, if someone else went there and I thought they were a hack and they were doing the same thing, I would certainly not think, wow, that is a really cool thing that they went and did.
Yeah. You wouldn't go to like Ferguson and be like, life is beautiful. Right. Tag that everywhere.
Right.
That's just like not, it's like not the tone.
Yeah.
And so also just not the tone for Ground Zero.
Right.
Like,
but he was hired to do that
as a memorial to 9/11, but probably by a real estate company.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's like someone scanned a list, like some article on complex.com about like, what are the, you know, the biggest selling 20 street artists.
Or like, and then Madonna used him for like an album cover too. But also this ties in, I mean, I think we were talking about like, where does the money really come from? If we really like do a real follow the money, there is like a piece in The Observer about Terry Guetta actually having a bunch of real estate holdings. What I wasn't clear on is if they all came after he kind of had the success or like during the success, because I feel like I was saying earlier, like my sympathy with him is just like, well, I don't want this guy to like lose his house with his kids and his wife and his business just because he kind of has like a big dick contest with Banksy, you know, like that's stupid.
Yeah. That Reddit AMA that I mentioned earlier, that guy says that it was, well known that he'd had a lot of family money and that he was basically a landlord of a lot of different buildings around LA.
That makes sense in the sense of like, he is never home. He doesn't seem to have very much interest in his actual job, but he does have like that kind of hustle. Like even like, he's like, oh, I found these jeans and for $15, right. I sell them for $5,000.
Right.
And actually even,
shamelessness.
One of the DVD extras is like, it was a CBS building. So there's all these like old, like, you know, stacks of like, you know, racks for like, I don't know, equipment. And he's like, this is taking up room. I don't want to deal with this. So he puts it on Craigslist because someone wanted to charge him $150,000 to take it out.
Paying someone to haul it away.
he gets like, he doesn't get money for it, but he makes them work. He's like, you want this? Also tear down this wall that needs to be torn down.
That's
so
great.
He really like knows how to make the maximum out of every angle. Like that is like kind of an art in it. The art of the deal, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's ultimately what he has ended up doing, is he's like a business guy. Like he even, you know, even in the scenes where he's like creating, he's not, he's like sort of
a creative director.
Yeah.
He's
like screaming at people like a boss, like just like, you know, do this, you know, like
is that what a creative director does?
Not in my experience, but Yeah, that's good stuff. That he basically like got out of having to pay people to haul it away by getting people to come take it for free.
Yeah,
it's genius.
Yeah, yeah. So he has some geniuses in him. Now we like to play a game called Cast This Doc.
Gotta cast this doc. Gotta cast this doc.
Do you have some ideas about if you're going to make a biopic version of Exit Through the Gift Shop? Firstly, you can cast anyone to be Banksy right now.
Right.
As long as you throw like a vocoder on him. Yeah.
Yeah. But you want to try to actually cast him though.
Yeah. Because you have, what do you think? Because I didn't really, like, I think I threw out Clive Owen.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I think of, like, Inside Man type scenario.
But I'm going to go a little... about John Krasinski.
Okay. Yeah. American him up a little bit. You said Daniel Craig before.
Yep.
I could also, like, the fact that that parkour scene, I guess you could see him, like, jumping over, like, fences and getting away from cops and stuff. That seems very, like, Daniel Craig-y.
Yeah.
And then you said,
that's a good one.
For Thierry, for Mr. Brainwash. Actually, I want to say Paul F. Tompkins because he does that. Because
you know he does a good impersonation of him.
He does just like a buffoonish Frenchman.
I would say John C. Reilly would be someone I'd like to see in that role.
Wow.
Doing a combination Steve Brule, but a French Steve Brule vibe.
A bigger dude, yeah. I also thought of for Shepard Fairey, and I thought of this because I just saw First Reformed, Ethan Hawke.
That's a good one.
Yeah. They weirdly are sort of like merging in the kind of the weird forehead area. I think they kind of have a similar look. Yeah.
Yeah. I could definitely see that. I think Jared Leto would be the other person that comes to mind for him.
Jared Leto for Shepard Fairey.
Yeah.
I feel bad for Mrs. Brainwash.
Right.
A lot of this.
Yeah.
Is she Italian or she's French also? I kind of like... couldn't pick up on her accent.
She seems long-suffering. That's what I would say.
It seems like she wanted kids and he was just like, okay, I pay for it.
Right.
That was basically what the deal must have
been. I mean, even before he's become a famous artist, he doesn't seem to ever actually be at home. Like they have like basically 5 minutes to talk to her, where every scene is her in the kitchen. So we keep referring back to that same footage where she's talking about him. But yeah, he's like traveling around the world with these guys documenting shit for years, going to, you know, France and all over the US too, just sort of like
everywhere. Plan.
Yeah.
Game plan.
No one paying him to do it either.
Yeah. It's like the film was calling his bluff, essentially. It was like, hey, you're going to make a documentary, right? He's like, yeah.
Right.
I'll hire a guy.
Right.
But also, like, he seems like the kind of dad who is just like almost like the wolf pack type of dad. Just like, everything's about me, guys. Everything is. And like, so someone who's like, kind of a narcissist and has ADD, just seems like unpleasant to be around most of the time, to the point where, like, this other thing, when he does this one group show, I think it's in 2011 or something in, I think, London, that I think Banksy put together, he's there to do a group show and then he ends up like not finishing something and like other people chip in to help him cut his stencil.
Oh yeah.
And it's just like, and then he just sits back and it's like, I'm autographing it. It's just so...
Because he'd rather... and the reason why is because he'd rather literally be doing an interview outside than finishing up the work.
Yeah, right? Yeah, totally. So it's just like so much... And I think about this too. Like, I guess I've had this thought as a creative person watching. I think any creative person can watch this and identify with either person. They can either identify with like the hardworking, you know, I guess you'd say the Shepard Fairies and the Banksys, or they can identify with Terry, because we've all been kind of the little brother in a scenario, and I'm kind of like, I'm like, oh Jesus, I wonder if this is what other people viewed me as.
Right.
At some point, like even it could be like, we're the little brother podcast, I don't know, like it could be that, or it could just be like, oh, I think I'm killing it and I'm not. Like, the lack of self-awareness is really like, you need a little bit of that.
Oh yeah.
To do anything, you need a little bit of that false bravado to get anything done, or you're just going to crumble in like self-doubt.
Yeah, I think it's hard to, it's like you would watch Terry and you would have a feeling about him, and that feeling is either going to be one that comes from a sense of like, well, I relate to it a little bit, and I never want anyone to see me that way. So like you, it's almost like identifying and knowing like, oh my God, like there are people see me that way in any measure at all. And sort of like the revulsion that you might feel or the derision that you would level at him is sort of rooted in, you know, hating the things that you identify with the most. And then, or you would, you know, just sort of resent the, you know, the sort of vacuousness of it. And, but again, like to have an opinion about that even at all, you have to have some internal fear about being seen that way, like, you know, your own legitimacy,
which is why I'm going to say go home, watch Nathan Barley, because it is a lot about like the guy who is like trying to like fight what he thinks is inauthentic, but like his authenticity is never really in question in his own mind, you know,
and getting paid by a corporation to do it.
Yeah. It's like, it's also like, just like what does the thing they say about like what hipsterdom is about is like the narcissism of small differences.
Mm-hmm.
It's like nothing more than like, just like creating in groups and out groups in a certain sense. But just like this idea, like I am authentic. This isn't authentic. I feel like actually at the end of this, I'm going to say like, I give props to Banksy for like having the self-awareness of being like, this is a Funhouse mirror version of me.
Right.
Like he knows that. And the question after all of this is, I feel like even Terry would be like, what a great documentary.
Yeah, it's unclear. I really that
showed
he would
a lot of
like
stuff.
Yeah.
There should have been more explosions.
Right. I don't think that he would have seen that and thought that it made him look bad. I think it seems like a celebration.
It's like the kind of like humor would just go over his hat.
Yeah, his big pork pie hat.
All right. Eric, is there any stuff you want to promote, like some music stuff you've been doing?
I'll say quickly, the reason I said John Krasinski was because I was just trying to throw a random white guy out with brown hair, not because I think that he is particularly well suited to play Banksy or because he's British, which he's not. Music to promote. Yeah, I have, there's a EP by my group. It's called Dos Feliz. I happen to be sitting here in Los Feliz right now. This is Dos Feliz.
Yeah, where Shepherd Fairey also lived for a long time. There's a lot of stickers all over the place.
You still see him?
I don't see him around, but yeah. I guess he talks about, he was on the Los Feliz podcast. So
nice.
He used to live in this neighborhood.
Excellent.
I'm gonna guess that side of Franklin,
right?
Like the nice side of Franklin.
So Dos Feliz, that's available on Plug Research Records. I am also in a rap duo called Not the Ones, and we have our third record coming out soon on Gold Robot.
Nice. And they're like another Oakland label, Gold Robot.
Yeah, that's actually based in Boston. It was Boston Oakland now, back in the day, and now it's in Boston.
Nice. And thank you for coming all the way over. Thank you for supporting us on Patreon.
Hey, my extreme pleasure. I love this show. It's super fun.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. And follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
And please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scovel.
If you want us to cover a doc, have suggestions for guests, or you just want to reach out, please email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.